Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance on this Memorial Day weekend to learn about a new memorial in progress. It's going to end up listing the names of quite a few veterans we've met on this program over the years, those who finished their journeys on Earth at the Veterans Home of California in Fresno. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com, you can see plans for this memorial and even participate in a very personal way that we're going to flesh out in a bit. That amazing facility is soon going to celebrate its 10th anniversary. Its very existence traces back to the Central California Veterans Home Support Foundation, which fought to get it built and has continued to support its residents in ways the government can't. More now from Public Information Officer Julie Cusseter.
The foundation said, what if we did some sort of memorial for all these veterans that have passed away? So we started looking into it, and one thing led to another, and we have the Fresno Veterans Home Memorial Project. And that memorial project has blossomed into a huge event where we've gotten support from different companies throughout the Central Valley. Well-known, you know, architects and engineers, electricians have volunteered their time, have donated their time and talents and designs. Design Lab 252 came up with the plans for this project, and it's going to be at the entrance of the home. As you're walking in, you park in the visitor area. There are going to be 5 walls and 5 benches. There's going to be a pillar in the middle that'll have all the different branches of the military on it, and it's going to have all the names, year of birth, year of death, and branch of service that the veterans served in. Right now, we'll probably have over 400 names on those walls, which you talk about experiences and triggering memories. Going through this experience, reaching out to all these family members, checking on their contact information has been a real emotional journey for me, because I remember all these veterans, many of them I was close to and I had a relationship with. And so we are very excited about this project, and we're very excited about when we're going to be unveiling it. It'll be coincide with our 10-year anniversary. So it's going to be a huge event that will take place on October 18th, 2023. It's a Wednesday. Like I said, we're just really looking forward to this project coming to fruition. It's been quite a journey for the foundation and myself to go through. We've been very fortunate. Also, we got assistance from Congressman Jim Costa through appropriation funding. His staff said we might be eligible to apply for appropriation funding, and we were granted that money, and that's going to help us build this project. So we're very, very grateful to Congressman Costa and his staff for helping us out.
And you can help in that effort too. Go to hometownheroesradio.com to find out how, and Julie's going to spell it out more clearly by the time we finish our program today. But let's hear now from the president of the Central California Veterans Home Support Foundation, himself a Vietnam veteran from the 82nd Airborne, Glenn McGee.
Well, the foundation is the group that got together to build this home in the first place. They had the vision to build this home. It's a crazy history of some pretty important people here in this town that had this vision, and we can go through the names and everybody would understand who they were. Most of all are gone, but as we say, the home opened 10 years ago. It was a $185 million project. The funds were brought in by this foundation and built this home and gave a place for these veterans that live here in the Central Valley and other places, actually, a place to live. The foundation is only a small group of people that are really interested. Nobody's paid. Nobody even makes their expenses, nothing. All the money that we receive to the foundation has to go back into the veterans here at the home. That's our bylaws. That's what we do. It's amazing what we're able to accomplish primarily by people just giving to us. We have a spaghetti dinner every year in October that pays for Christmas. The people here generally have no Christmas at all. Their families sometimes ignore them. That's more the case than you think. And we supply a Christmas present every year and some other things. And it's really a great time when we fill those stockings in December for all these veterans. But these guys and gals here in this home, they look forward to those stockings every year, and they know they're going to get something. If you look around, you'll see them wearing shirts that we gave them, or pullovers, or bags, or whatever we give them. And they're very appreciative of that. And that's what we do. And now we've got this huge project of building a memorial wall out here, walls, that we can put these names of those that have passed. I've gotten to know a lot of these guys. I've been president of this foundation now for 7 years, I think, or eight.
Really?
Yeah, it's been a while.
Wow.
And I've gotten to know these guys very, very well. And then Julie tells me, oh, you know, Mr. Appleton just died, and these different friends that I've made. It's hard because I'm a veteran myself. I'm a Vietnam veteran. So I feel a brotherhood with these other guys, and they feel it with me that I'm one of them. And this is a wonderful place to live. The people that live here, the veterans themselves, if you talk to them about this wall, they tear up, even thinking that we're even considering doing this. And they are just loving the idea. We've had veterans here from Pearl Harbor survivors. We still have at least one lady. She's 104, and she was a nurse in World War II, and she still is pretty active. And we've got several of these individuals that we really owe a lot to, and they all have a story.
Let's hear another one of those stories. Glenn mentioned Pearl Harbor survivors. The home has ended up with a couple Pearl Harbor survivors who've shared their stories on this program, including a Purple Heart Marine named Elmer Wright.
Late about, missed about 20 minutes after the explosion there in Pearl Harbor. We had general quarters. We didn't have no ammunition or nothing, but we stood out with the rifles and all that, but I don't know what we could have done. Didn't have ammunition for them.
And where were you guys?
Right outside the harbor. Now, they never bombed nothing outside the harbor. They never bombed the sub base either. They hit the U.S. Maryland. They hit it in number one turret and busted it. That's the ship I was supposed to went on, but so we waited there in the, I think the Colorado was in Brimpton, Washington then. When it come there, we went aboard there.
So you're on this oil tanker outside of Pearl Harbor, and the first thing that tells you something that's going on is they sound general quarters and say, we're under attack, we're at war, or what?
Yeah. Well, everybody was kind of decided. Now, the two Japanese planes come. It was coming back from Pearl Harbor after they jumped the bomb. They flew right over us, but someone said, yeah, they're Japanese. Then the second or third day, they lowered a boat. Rowboats, and we didn't have motors. There's nine of us, and we made a landing down there outside Pearl Harbor in the cane field there, and I was sick. And I wanted to lay down and let them go, and they said, no, we don't leave no Marines behind. And we went on that way. We got made into Marine barracks before dark, but boy, I was sick that day. It didn't matter to me what happened. I didn't think I was going to make it. But about 3 days later, I got feeling better, and they made a mess cook out of me. And that about 7 or 8 days, then we started putting out balloons up in the air with cables on them. In case planes come in, they'd hit them cables. Then second day after we got them balloons up in the air, one of our own planes hit it out there in the harbor.
Well, some have said that if they actually had barrage balloons in place before December 7th, that it would have prevented the air attack or at least limited it. I've got to ask you about that scene there, though, on December 7th. Do you remember looking out and seeing the aftermath of that attack, seeing the smoke from the Arizona?
When night come around, you could see it real good, too. Yeah, we must have been a mile out from the entrance of the harbor.
So you said when night fell, you could see it. So you could still see fire burning, or what?
Yeah, a lot of smoke.
Did that add some fuel to your fire? Did that motivate you to go out there and fight the Japanese?
Not really. We mostly concentrated on our job, what we had to do. I know one time, well, it's off Saipan, there's a eight planes coming 80 miles away. The time we got up on the guns, the planes was already there. I think we knocked down three or four of them. And one of them, dropped a torpedo, hit one of the ships.
I did mention Elmer Wright was a Purple Heart Marine, and that part of his story would occur on the battleship USS Colorado.
I had a lot of fear for the guys that got killed. But now, we buried a bunch of them at sea there. We had a rifle team, but I don't know if they were sailors or Marines, what they were, but we had a firing team. put a stretcher, two 5-inch shells in a stretcher, and lowered the other side and buried them at sea. We done that all day once. I don't know how many we buried there, but I think most of them were sailors. But on Tinian now down there, when we come back to Guam, we fired star shells. A lot of Japanese swimming from Saipan over Tinian. We kept that going all night long. But 2nd, 4th Marines, I don't think they had any trouble at all on the other side of the island.
Right, but the side you're on, and this is late July 1944, you're on the USS Colorado. You've already participated in the bombardment of Saipan and Guam, and now you're at Tinian, famous, of course, as the launching point for the Enola Gay a year later. But as you're helping to capture this island in July of 1944, you are working on your gun emplacement, other guys blasting away with theirs, but you are a little closer to shore than usual, and your ship received some serious damage there.
Our ship got hit. I don't know why we was in there so close. Well, the machine gun fire, you could see it flash up out of this buck brush and stuff. We were firing machine guns there. We could have got out there 5 miles away from the island and with those heavy guns and battered that out. Yeah, there's a big battery in the way up on the ridge, come out of a cave, a tunnel. And we supposed to made a, troops made a fake landing on the side. We was on the north side, and the 4th and 2nd Marines is on the other side. We supposed to draw the enemy to our side, but we did all right. And there was 7 barges there, and they sunk every one of those. Our ship had just sat there close, just go around. Starboard side all fire, then the port side. I don't know why the skipper kept doing that. They're trying to get away from them, get out of the line of fire. We could have been out there 10 miles still bummed that island.
And you were on a 20-millimeter the whole time?
Yeah, we had, the 7 of us got killed on that group. We had 3 guns there and 10 men there. I can name most of them. Platoon Sergeant Bunch, he was laying there on the gun tub. He was laying there at the end, something coming out of his throat, so he was dead. And on the gun I was on there, we had 3 men to a gun, and I had Narboard. We had 1 guy hanging in the harness. He got killed. He was laying there in the harness, still the gun sticking up in there. Then Narboard come down. He fell right on his stomach right in front of me. I was standing there, and I got pretty bad in my leg and back wounded. And Private Glass come and fell right over the top of him. He was mumbling something to me. I never could figure out what he was saying, but and I seen blood come out of his mouth, and he gulped, and he died. And there was Sabinski at the other end. Corporal Sabinski, he had his whole leg shot off, and he was standing up on that one leg praying, and still alive, and there was a couple of corpsmen come up there. And they bandaged my leg up, put a tourniquet around it and everything. And I said that I told him to take care of Sabinski first, and all we can't help him. Later on, they load us in stretchers. They'd load us down stretchers to the main deck. It was set up about 12, 14 feet below the main deck. Give me a good shot of morphine and take me down to the Marine quarters there and laid me down. Most all them guys was dead in there, laying there. And I says, boy, this can't happen to me. I thought maybe they'd take me for dead because I passed out from morphine, I guess. And when I woke up, I was on a hospital ship. I don't even remember them taking me off the ship even. And on there, the funny thing is a Japanese corpsman. I thought I was on a Japanese ship there for a while. And I played like I wouldn't open my eyes. And finally, a Navy commander come in there, and he wanted to know I was in. The guy above me, he got stepped on a mine. Boy, his leg was that big around. He's a lieutenant. And so this commander talked to him. He says, try to keep him awake up there. Keep talking. He kept talking about the Keys College and all that. But he died that night. And we went on to New Caledonia, Mob 5 Naval Hospital there. And I was so bad, a couple guys come in to visit me. That I was with is on the ship there. They had minor injuries. One of them couldn't stand to even look at me. And I even attempted suicide. I couldn't figure out how to do it, and I got thinking, well, I'd take a sleeping pill. They'd put one up, put it on my pillow. I got about 7 or 8 of them. I saw them both, that knocked me out. And so finally, they pumped my stomach and come out, and the chaplain, he sat there, and he took me out of the suicide stuff. And I really didn't want to come home. I didn't want people to see me like things are.
Wow. I can't tell you how much I appreciate your candor. You went through things that most people never will, and certainly none of us wants to, but you're really making this real for us and helping us understand not just what you went through, but what so many others did, and even today, the things our men and women in uniform are dealing with. You were on a roll there, and I didn't want to interrupt, but I do want to go back a little bit now. Obviously, you were in need of repair and healing, but your ship was too. You were on the USS Colorado, and this big battleship is in close to shore to shell Tinian, but the Colorado ended up taking 22 hits itself during this time, damaged badly enough that the ship would have to go back to the West Coast for repairs after that. And the Japanese, it seems, had a lot more firepower on that island than your leaders expected.
When that big gun come out of that mountain, they had a tunnel all the way through that mountain, its own tracks. Boy, they sure laid it on us.
When you saw those big shells coming your way, was that happening for a while before you yourself got wounded? Did you have time to...
When they started, we got hit right off. The two shells hit right amongst us, sir.
What happened to you? Where did you get hit? What did it feel like? How did you react to that?
Well, I was on mostly Sabetsky standing there on one leg to help him, but they put terminal around my leg. Then when they left, I felt my coveralls on fire and put my hand out of cover with blood. That kind of bothered me a little bit. They couldn't put no tourniquet on my buttocks. So they finally got it and trapped me in that stretcher and lowered me down and they gave me a lot of morphine. I passed out.
So a shell from that big 8-inch gun came in, just exploded, and you didn't know where you were hit.
No. I know my shoe was off my foot, but my leg and my back injury, they never even checked my back. They put a tourniquet until they got the rest of the guys off. They taken the dead ones the last. They're still laying up in the tub.
Was there any part of you that wasn't sure you were going to survive?
Yeah, and the ammunition box got on fire, and we had these 5 buckets of sand for incinerator bombs. They burned right through the deck. So I picked that up. That was after I was wounded, too, and I threw that at and covered that tank. And I put the fire out. I got a Bronze Star for it. And on the other side of the Marine put out, he was kind of a yard bird. Nobody liked him very much. But the colonel gave him a Silver Star. So I met this colonel out up by Dobbins, California, couple years ago, and I asked him, how come I just get a Bronze Star? And the other guy got, oh, he saved more lives than you did. Yeah, there wasn't but 3 of them. Yeah, it was Jones and Olson and me. That was only 3 that lived on that. All the rest of them were killed.
Elmer Wright came oh so close to being one of those over 400,000 Americans who did not come home from World War II, the ones we honor this Memorial Day weekend, along with all of those who have ever died in the service of our country. But Elmer's name will soon be on a memorial at the facility where he lived out his final days, and we'll learn more about that and how you can remember a vet who may otherwise be forgotten and help make that special memorial possible when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.